counsel for appellate. Could you say, tell me how to pronounce your client's name? All right, Bamatelli Adetifa versus
Naplanza Paybe.
Naplanza Paybe respondent. Adetifa petitioner, Paybe respondent. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. When you start your arguments, please state your name and the party you represent. The podium has a toggle switch that puts it up and down as you're comfortable for your height. And so, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, go ahead. We're ready for you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Randall Smith, and I represent Bamatelli Adetifa, who is present today, also two student attorneys at my firm.
Is your mic muted?
I don't think so.
Is this working, or?
Yeah, I think just project more.
Okay.
That's voice activated in no sense, so just
absolutely
talk
apologize
loud
for that.
Okay.
My client is here, Bamatelli Adetifa, also two student attorneys from my firm, Sydney Kohler and Daphne Karofsky are present as well. This case originated out of Hennepin County District Court.
And your name
court.
Is?
Randall Smith.
Thank you. Okay.
Sorry. This case originated out of Hennepin County District Court, a referee Jason Hutchinson, Judge Terry Yellowhammer. Use of discretion is the standard of review. That's in my brief. There's five sections to my appeal in addition to a brief we have or a motion for attorney's fees. So I'm going to be brief in each area so I don't have to rush through any of them individually. Happy to answer questions on the fly as well as you have questions. The first area is we believe the district court erred with respect to the designation of sole physical custody to mother. We did have a custody evaluation in this case, and I will note to the court I was not on the case for the first year approximately. So I took the case, I would say seventh inning, using baseball terminology, late in the game. But that custody evaluation, I think, was well done. But I think as far as how the district court looked at that and applied those best interest factors to the custody label is questionable. I think I take a prospective view of the parenting approach. My client's a wonderful father. And I think it's based upon those best interest factors and how we look at them.
Counsel, I've been doing this stuff for a long time. I'm an old guy. But everything we were trained as trial court judges when I was a trial court judge that dealt with the best interest factors and the issues of joint legal and joint physical custody, and we heard as part of Justice Blatt's Children's Justice Initiative from all kinds of experts at training that we went to for that, that you just don't do joint physical custody on a child that's less than 7 years old. Why shouldn't I think that now?
I've had a lot of cases with joint physical with kids less than 7 years old. I think in this situation,
the attorneys have kind of adopted this idea that there's almost a default to joint physical custody, but that's not the rule.
It's not the rule.
There's no default the other way.
Correct. I think it depends on who you speak with, whether it's a judge, a lawyer, a mental health provider, and the parents as well. And I think the lens is best interest of the child. And I think as far as how the judge wrote this order, you see in the order, you know, favors mother, favors father, neutral. I think the optics and the lens is best interest of the child. So I think...
Okay, but what I'm telling you is everything that I know about this is that it's not in the best interest of a child under seven. So how do you get me by that?
I'm not aware of any case law that says that, and I'm aware of Justice Blatt's work, and I appreciate that, but I'm not aware of case law that says for a child under seven or any published case that says joint physical is not helpful or useful. I've had a lot of cases where it is, but I think it is very case-specific. And there's a movement, I think, especially in Hennepin, for joint-joint. But, we have different parts of the state, I think, that view it quite differently, depending on where you're at.
Can you explain to me a little bit more about the findings on the individual factors? Like, what the court should do. I think you're arguing they should do something then other than say father favors
Correct.
Mother's neutral. What should they do? What's wrong with the way the district court did it?
Yeah, I think the analysis is pre-2015. So as we had the new statute and the new kind of framework for us to follow, what I saw here was more reflective of something 20 years ago or even 10. I'm not saying it's wrong, but I'm saying it's not really up to date with the changes that we have. For example, best interest factor 10, maximizing child's time with each parent, I think that can be very easily done in this case by having joint physical.
But wasn't the custody evaluator, in a sense, an expert in this case? And wasn't the custody evaluator saying to the judge, this child's too young?
That goes to the
joint physical custody, or because there was such a delay in starting the parent-child relationship with the father that ultimately supports the issue that mom should have the child and dad should, in a gradual way, move to a 50-50, maybe even in this case, before the child's 7.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation. There's a framework for equal parenting time, and I think, too, this goes to prong two of the argument as far as a child being a bit too young for effective equal parenting time. But I think Mr. Braxton did a very nice job. That framework was in place before I was on the case. I would have had some different ideas as to how we would use someone to...
You know, the issue that seemed to trouble the court the most was the animosity these two parents have towards each other and how that impacted their ability to exercise joint physical custody, at least at this point in time. And it may not be fair to your client that he didn't get the kind of opportunity he should have from the start, but we don't look at necessarily what's fair to the parties. We look at what's in the best interest of the child. You have to kind of deal with where we're at when you look at that. But why would the court be wrong if it had just relied on that first of the physical custody criteria that you look at and just said these people don't get along well enough to do joint physical custody at this time? Let's see what happens.
I would agree that there is a heightened level of animosity between the parents, and my goal as Mr. Adetifa's attorney is to get a framework in place for effective co-parenting so the parties aren't back in court, so that this child can be raised without litigation and conflict. But yes, the parties are high conflict. That's well noted. Mr. Braxton noted that. I think that is part of the issue. Can they be great co-parents? Yes, I believe they can be. But that healing and that process sometimes can take a while. But that I think was a big part of the case from what I observed also, too. I think that was some of the frustration the custody evaluator had, was how to build something, a bridge perhaps that doesn't exist quite yet.
Wasn't there a program that they went through that was supposed to help that?
Yes, the program is great, and they've completed that, but that program and that training and that sliver of time doesn't make up for all of the pieces that exist with that. So I think there needs to be an ongoing effort for the parents, not just the program that they both completed, but other sorts of remedies where they can work on how to co-parent this little one, even though they're no longer in a relationship. So yes, there was heightened animosity, absolutely, and I think that's reflected in the record.
And I suspect maybe this is troubling to your client on another level because he has another child where he actually has what he'd like to have here. Is that a correct?
Correct. So I think you have a 180 departure. So you have one situation, his other child, where I think it's very healthy and effective co-parenting communication. Whereas in this case, it is challenging because it's quite the opposite, or it has been. I think it can improve to that level, but I think it's fair to say it's still very high conflict between the two of them.
You know, when I was doing these cases, what always troubled me, especially with little kids, and by that I mean anybody under 12, yeah, is kids get confused with these custody arrangements in the real world because what a child really needs is that constancy of place that comes with having my room, so to speak. And when a child is always saying, well, I have a room at my dad's house and I have a room at my mom's house, the child doesn't really have a room. And that's a lot of what the experts would talk about as to why this is difficult with what young children. Aren't there a lot of countervailing things we should be thinking about?
There are. There are, absolutely. And I think, too, it's a tough case. I mean, it's there's hurt feelings. There's things that have to be mended still. But as far as the work, I think the referee adopted Mr. Bracton's report very closely. I think that the referee could have gone a different way with some of the portions of the best interest factors. And looking at the lens best, you know, a check system, more or less, for parent, you know, which parent does this favor? I don't know.
So should instead it be that on each factor, I mean, you do agree it should go through all of the, each of the factors.
Yes.
And then what should it conclude, that it favors joint versus sole? I mean, you know, I'm trying to
Correct.
Figure out what is that, what's the better framing for the district court's analysis?
I think a lens that would be more helpful, instead of having the old school system of check boxes, who it favors, and, you know, at the end, tally up to see which parent has the most checks. I think maybe more of a, looking at best interest factor 10, and we weigh them all, but maximizing time with both parents. And I think, too, the message from Mr. Braxton is that these parents are high conflict, but there's an option here. There is a time period during which equal parenting time might work. I think developmentally, because she didn't get to see dad for quite some time when she was young, that bonding and attachment has to take place. But developmentally, I think even Mr. Braxton recognized there would be a time period during which that door would be properly opened. I think the question is, at what point? The parties have already litigated this case heavily, going back to court repeatedly for motions, whether it be child support or this, is cost ineffective, and I think there's better options. But at some point, I think they will be conversational as parents, where they can have communication about their daughter, as opposed to having to have the lawyers be at the forefront of that piece.
So it seems like, all right, so when we look at the best interest factors, which the court has to weigh,
yes.
And I appreciate your argument, you're taking issue with the checkmark system to help prompt that weighing. You're saying that the weighing, I'm not sure exactly how the court's supposed to weigh them, other than just like explain each of them and sort of do a holistic weighing at the end or something. But either way it is, where's the abuse of discretion in this case about this custody decision?
I think, too, with respect to why he didn't have parenting time, why daughter was absent. Unmarried parents, he didn't have any options really until there was a court action litigated. He didn't have overnights and parenting time until I was on the case. I think for a year a lot of things happened, but there wasn't a lot of progress as far as him being father, being active in daughter's life. So I think recognizing why he was absent in more detail, it wasn't though
well,
he was...
So is the court supposed to ignore that then? I mean, I think the case law kind of goes the other way, that, you know, that even if it happened the way it did, what's best for the kid is a more gradual adjustment, which is what was recommended. I mean, so why you know, because then it's fault-based on the parents, is what you're saying.
Correct.
And that's not the analysis.
No, it's not fault-based whatsoever. I just think, too, can't go back in time, but if I had touched the case early, there would have been different movements. So I think, ideally, the trial wouldn't have happened, but the best interest factor analysis, we have case law point. I think we just, from my perspective, my client's perspective, believes that the judge didn't get it right this time. And I think a lot of parents feel that way, but I think in Hennepin, the default kind of is joint-joint. I know there are cases that aren't currently, but he's a great father, and I think, too, it's unfortunate that there was that delay. There was that lapse in time where he wasn't able to initiate and be a dad to a little one because he sure wanted to be. It just didn't work out until...
Of course, you have the problem of your prior counsel indicating there had been an agreement and then not
yes, you're right.
around to let the judge know, well, maybe
yep.
we don't for three
yep.
months.
And that goes to...
You know, that was hardly the fault of mom.
I agree. And that goes to... one of the other arguments for the appeal, too, that time period, August 25th through November 23rd, for the attorney's fees portion of 1425, I don't think there was an agreement or a meeting of the minds. I know what the record says, but if there was an agreement, we wouldn't have had a trial. And I think you look at Tornstrom.
No, but you have buyer's remorse in these cases all the time.
Absolutely.
You know, and I've often had that as a trial court judge, and it was usually the next day.
Yes.
And then, you bring them back into court and kind of talk about things. Can we get back to where you were, or why can't we get back? And usually you'd end up somewhere around that point, and you'd actually do it on the record at that hearing that would be scheduled rather shortly. That might be harder to do in Hennepin County, but that's just my experience of what happened in those kinds of situations.
Yeah, that troubled me, that 90-day stretch during where nothing much happened. But two, and I've cited the cases in my brief as far as Jalen Viegri, but there's other cases too. Was there an agreement? Was there a meeting of the minds? Were conduct-based attorney's fees appropriate? And I don't believe that they were. And I don't think the record was so crystal clear as to say that there was an agreement, a comprehensive one, especially in a high-conflict case like this. I think the meeting of the minds is questionable. I know what prior counsel said and what the record says, but to me it is confusing. If there was no agreement, why the judge didn't call him in and get something on the record? I realize my time has expired, Your Honor. I can complete the rest on my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Amy Helsine. The last E is silent. Helsine, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Naplanza Pebe, who was also the respondent on the district court level. Having heard appellant's argument, I again stress to the court that the standard of review here is not the decision was questionable. The standard of review is not my client doesn't like what the trial court ordered. The standard is not in Hennepin County, it should have been joint. The standard of review here is abuse of discretion. And in order to show an abuse of discretion, appellant has to show that the court misapplied the law or that its decision was based on facts not in the record. And I don't see anywhere in appellant's brief, and I didn't hear anything this morning, that supports an argument or a finding that the district court either misapplied the law or based its decision on facts not in the record. The trial court issued an order on September 7th, 2022, and then later an order for attorney's fees of September 27th, 2022, that was detailed, that was thoughtful, that analyzed all of the best interest factors pursuant to the statute, that addressed the standard for awarding conduct-based attorney's fees, that included multiple calculations for child support. This is a case where the court clearly understood its role as far as what it had to decide, what standards it was to use to decide, to make those decisions. And appellant's argument fails to acknowledge that fact. This is a case involving two parents who never parented together. To claim that this is a default joint 50-50 case is not accurate. The respondent has never seen the appellant with their child, and vice versa. These two ended their relationship when respondent became pregnant. They weren't together during the pregnancy either. This is not a case where these two have any history of co-parenting together.
When exactly did he first learn that he might be the father?
Well, according to the testimony, appellant advised him as soon as she found out that she was pregnant, and she received a very negative reaction, i.e., I don't want to have a baby with you. And then there was no communication once the child was born, appellant requested that he be advised of the child's birth. He was. And then after the child was born, I can't remember how old she was. She was at least 3 months old. The appellant requested blood tests, which outside of the court process, my client, the respondent, agreed to. They met in a parking lot so that the swabs could be taken for the child. And my client asked to be advised of the results, and the appellant said, it's none of your business. And that was the last time these two ever met in person outside of parenting time exchanges.
Again, so was there any effort then before this litigation to arrange for him to see the baby?
Absolutely. There's testimony in the record that shows that the respondent was encouraged the appellant to see the child. The issue was that the respondent asked to be present and appellant refused to see the child with the mother present.
Okay.
He would only see the child if she dropped the child off with him and left. And once the county instituted child support and child support action, then appellant commenced a custody action in district court. Again, it should have been a paternity, but my client conceded that he was the father, and the parties executed a recognition of parentage after the process had commenced. My client has no disagreement that appellant is the father. She's always known he was the father. She would very much like for him to have a relationship with the child and have a loving, close relationship. The problem here is that these two don't talk. They don't talk. They have no communication about the child outside of what we would call emergency or time-sensitive communication.
So that program they went through didn't do any good, is what you're saying?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, but they did both complete it. It's called the Bridging Parental Conflict, and it really is a great program that many parents benefit from, but the issues here were not resolved in that way. So going back to this, to the trial court's decision, again, the trial court went through all of the best interest factors. Any claim by appellant in his brief that the court did not analyze all of the best interest factors is not true. While the court did use a weighing system, there's no authority to support any argument that that's somehow an abuse of discretion or misapplying the law. I'm sure the court has seen many other orders that do a similar or perform a similar analysis when it comes to child custody or parenting time questions. I certainly have. And we have to remember that the trial court is granted broad discretion when it comes to custody and parenting time. Again, the argument that I would really like to have joint physical custody is not sufficient for this court to reverse that issue. And we request that the court affirm the trial court's decision with respect to physical custody and parenting time. I will... The only factor prior to today that the appellant raised with respect to a specific finding was the factor six, which addresses the historical parenting time. And I believe the court clearly understands that issue, so I won't go into it at length. But the trial court specifically found that appellant's argument was not in the best interest of the child, that appellant's argument was attempting to apply blame to respondent, and the trial court was not going to enter into that discussion. The trial court considered it And it is in the trial court order. There's no argument here that the trial court did not consider appellant's argument. He did. He just didn't agree. The trial court found that 6 out of the 12 factors in the best interest factors favored sole physical custody with respondent. The trial court had the benefit of recommendations from the court-appointed custody evaluator, and the trial court specifically found that the evaluation report was, quote, very thorough, thoughtful, and helpful to the trier of fact, unquote. The trial court further found that the recommendations were not cookie-cutter recommendations, that they were tailored to this case, to the best interests of this 2-year-old child. And this 2-year-old child had spent almost all of her 2 years on the planet in the care of respondent. And placing blame, as appellant has consistently tried to do, does not overcome the fact that in order to maintain consistency and stability for this very young child, that she needs to be in the primary custody of the person who has provided virtually all of the care for her up until that point. That's what's in her best interest. And the trial court performed that analysis, the custody evaluator performed that analysis, and there's absolutely no basis for this court to question that analysis or find that the trial court abused its discretion. As far as the parenting time goes, I'm not sure what appellant's argument is as far as why the district court was required to implement a 50-50 parenting time schedule. I know of no authority that requires the court to implement a 50-50 parenting time schedule. The trial court here, as expected, found that a 50-50 parenting time schedule would not be in a 2-year-old child's best interest, especially given the history of care, and as well as considering each party's ability to provide care in the future. The trial court consistently raised the issue of the underlying animosity between the parties. An appellant is attempting to ignore that fact in some of his arguments, but it cannot be ignored when it comes to the trial court's decision with respect to custody and parenting time. The trial court specifically raised concerns about the effect on the child of the parties' dislike for one another, but the trial court stated that its largest concern was the sudden disruption to the child's expectations of her daily life built up over the last 3 years if it had implemented appellant's parenting time schedule, and the trial court refused to do so. I only have a few minutes, but I just want to briefly address the few other issues that were raised. There's the child support issue. Again, this is I'm not sure what appellant is arguing as far as that goes, but again, the standard would be abuse of discretion. In this case, the court made detailed findings regarding the parties' incomes, the fact that I don't believe respondent's income is disputed. Regarding appellant's income, the findings in the trial court's order were based on appellant's own testimony and the tax returns provided at trial. The appellant did not provide any evidence that contradicts the court's findings, and I do encourage the court to review the transcript on that issue if there's any question as to the fact that appellant provided this own information in his own testimony.
Would the only real issue maybe be the fact that he had multiple jobs, which led to multiple pay, which may have at least inferred he was working more than 40 hours a week, which would seem to be all he'd have to account for on the child support determination.
And I believe the trial court, I am certain the trial court addressed that because this was addressed in testimony. in my cross-examination of the appellant. The appellant testified very clearly, very concisely, that he does not work over 40 hours a week. He averages 40 hours per week.
That is in the findings. I remember.
Yes, he does not work this. The income included in the trial court's order does not include income in excess of 40 hours a week. The income in the trial court order did not include any income from his rental property. The only income that was confirmed in the testimony that was also included in the trial court order was the income that appellant earns working a 40-hour work week. And he does have two employers, but he performs his duties during the same work hours for both employers. And I argued, and the trial court agreed, that that does not meet any exclusionary basis in the statute as far as excluding overtime work, because it is not overtime. The question of child support, however, given the appellant's income, these are not big, huge distinctions here. I mean, the child support obligation that he would have, regardless of how we calculate parenting time, I've argued that in the brief that the court appropriately used the statute that allows for an average of parenting time. These, if we exclude one income, or the issue is that he should be paying something, obviously. We'd like him to pay some child support. Appellant hasn't paid any voluntary child support for this child. And he somehow is, in his brief, argues that he shouldn't have to pay child support for the child because, again, it's mother's fault. And I want this court to remember that, because appellant wants to place blame on respondent for not getting the outcome that he wants. But the simple fact of the matter is that this is not about him. This is about a very young child who deserves the support of both of her parents. I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will be brief. I have 5 minutes. My client does pay child support. He has a $59,000 arrears, and he pays child support every month for his daughter in this case and also his son that he has with another person. So I don't know where that became part of the record.
Does he have the automatic, whatever it is?
He does, correct, Your Honor. Yep, and absolutely. So he's paying child support. I want to correct that. He's an upstanding person. As far as the amount that he pays, one of the questions I have and concerns I have about the trial court's order is that we're now in phase three of parenting time, which commenced March 13th of this year, which gives him 5 out of 14 overnights. And on page 29 of my addendum, and that's part of the trial court's order, for that prospective calculation, it uses 3 overnights out of 14. We're now at 5. The other piece is the trial court used, I think, as far as what his income might look like for 2022, some testimony, and they came up with $201,000. And that's incorrect. And in fact, in my affidavit, my responsive affidavit for the motion for attorney's fees, he clarifies that his income for 2022, we believe, is $160,000. His accountant is still working on that. So the court is using a wrong number to run the child support. They had tax returns for 2021, and they chose to use something else. As far as what his income was. So we have two pieces in that algorithm that I think need to be looked at. One is the overnights, one is his actual income.
You could, though, make a motion to modify, or are you limited because of the 20% rule or whatever?
Yeah, it would be very, that's a great point, very close as to do that, but also, too, with this case and then the ongoing litigation, I wanted to be as concise and efficient with the process, but I think those two pieces should be looked at, the actual overnights he has based upon that prospective order, which is 5 out of 14, and then his actual income. And I think, too, this motion for attorney's fees gave us a chance to update the court as to what his income looks like, which is $7,000 more than 2021. It's not 201. It went from 153 to about 160. So not a deadbeat dad, great dad doing his part. the animosity is there. He's not blaming anybody. This happens in a lot of relationships, even couples that have been together for 20 years that have little ones. Things happen. But there's no blame here. That's not the message we're sending. We're sending the message that the parties can do better. They both took the program, but that many times is just a Band-Aid on a bigger problem, and I think that's what we have here. And as far as a motion for attorney's fees, I will just indicate, too, that this has been challenging for him financially for both parties. He makes more, but he has more obligations with little ones. His passport was denied, so his family's in Nigeria, and we're trying to get that taken care of. His parents are older, so not traveling, not being able to see family, that's a separate issue. That's not part of this case, but we're doing everything we can to make good on this arrears piece to make sure that he can visit family, take his daughter perhaps back to Nigeria as well. But to label him as some sort of scofflaw on not paying his obligation is incorrect. We just want to make sure that what we're using for calculations line up with case law and statutes, and that the judge didn't get it wrong with his income, which I think clearly the judge did, and that does happen from time to time. The other piece, too, and this is, I see I have a minute and a half left. This won't take long. The income tax dependency exemption was reserved. I think with tax returns, the judge had tax returns. And I know the statute, there's four pieces to it. Clearly, the judge could have ordered one party, I think probably mom, to take that exemption. I don't know why it happened. Making the parties relitigate something and reserving it when they're already high conflict doesn't seem to make sense, especially when the parties' tax returns were for the judge to look at. So that didn't make much sense either. Give it to mom, that's fine, but don't reserve it so the parties have to keep fighting about something like this. I think, too, absent tax returns, maybe there's a question, but they have clean tax returns, enough testimony, two-day trial. I'm not missing anything. I think the judge should have just, frankly, awarded that to mom, perhaps for now, until the parenting time is equal. But that was perplexing, and once again, the parties are having trouble, so why the judge didn't just say, here, mom, take the tax dependency exemption. Don't make them go through any more than they need to go through. I'm happy to answer any questions, Your Honor.
Is there anything barring them from agreeing that mom takes it right now?
No. There's not, exactly. And if it was that easy, and in some cases it is, in many cases, in this case, they're not to that point. They're not conversational yet about daughter.
Okay, but I didn't say that so much as judgment. It's just that you said it could go to mom and maybe
correct.
So
yeah, they could.
That is obviously the stress of having to continue to fight is within the party's ability to avoid.
Yeah, I just think if the court said, here, this is how it's going to be, I'll say this, they both follow, when there's a framework, they both follow that framework from the bench. So I think having that in place just gives them less pieces to focus on, talk about. But I think it would be super helpful if there was some guidance as to how to do that, because I can see this being a per-year ongoing issue if it's not addressed properly. And I'd sure like for them to focus on being great parents, because I know they can, instead of figuring out who gets the tax exemption for next year.
Do they still alternate it?
They could alternate, too, perhaps, for that piece. Just some guidance would be helpful, because they're not in a position right yet to sit over coffee and say, hey, you know what, let's rotate it. This year, you take it next year. I'd love for that to happen, but without structure. And if there is structure, they will follow it. I will say that. But at this point, we don't have that yet. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
Thank you both. Have a good day. The decision will be out in a statutory time period. Thank you. And we are adjourned.
All rise.